The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark.
My name's Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA in Hawaii.
With a hard disk full of top secret documents and on the run from the National Security Agency, Snowden went public with a stated mission to inform Americans about what their governments already knew about them. Snowden gave those files to The Guardian as part of the biggest intelligence leak in history. So what's changed and what hasn't in the 8 months since the story first broke? Joining me in the studio are Luke Harding, who's the author of a new book, The Snowden Files, and by Ewan McCaskill, who's been one of the lead journalists on the story from the beginning. A warm welcome to you both. Now, through the twists and the turns of this complex tale, we've learnt first about how the intelligence services were keeping tabs not just on terror suspects, but on anyone who used a mobile phone or the internet. We learnt too about how Britain, where spooks operate under the looser rules of an unwritten constitution, was embroiled in this US-led blanket surveillance, which sometimes involved conspiring against supposed allies in Europe. And we discovered too how big IT corporations, which have often talked about protecting customers, had in fact bent over backwards to assist the authorities' drive to know everything about everyone. So, quite a story then. But Luke, half a year on, most of it is still going along. Is this a scoop with any real consequences?
That's the big question, Tom. Yes and no, I think, is the simple answer. Yes, insofar as you set out in your kind of introduction, we now know the sort of ambit, the protocols of this fantastic, previously secret Anglophone spying project, not just to target the bad guys, Al-Qaeda, corrupt Russian officials, terrorists, jihadists, but frankly anybody who uses a mobile or surfs the internet or logs onto Facebook. What we now know is that all of our data is being sucked up, that GCHQ is hacking fiber optic cables that run under the sea and land in Cornwall, that these agencies are making huge efforts to defeat encryption, and really that the concept of electronic privacy has become, without us even noticing, something of a joke. So that's where we're at. In terms of the reform process, President Obama stood up last month. He made a long speech of an hour where he tried to engage with some of these issues. And he announced a few reforms, but it's hard to know whether these are really reforms or reforms in inverted commas. He said, for example, the US would no longer spy on Mrs. Merkel, or other close friends and allies, and that the NSA would no longer hold all of this metadata, our kind of personal information, but it would go to some new and so far kind of non-existent entity. But to be honest, my impression is that it's essentially business as usual and that the NSA and GCHQ will, more or less, with a few tweaks, carry on.
I agree with Luke about that, but I do think there has been a fundamental change already. Luke's right. The changes Obama's announced are cosmetic, and I don't for a minute believe either the NSA or the GCHQ intend giving up power. You know, the reforms Obama announced were limited. But there has been a big change in Google, Microsoft, and the other companies. They're losing, in danger of losing billions because of the way people view them now, especially overseas. People have become sort of suspicious of American products. So that's a huge change. But the big change is in people's attitudes. I mean, before this story, I was vaguely unsure about whether email was safe, but now I realise you can't trust it at all, can't trust the phones. And I think everybody is like that now. Not everybody, but most people are much more questioning about whether it's safe. That's a monumental shift in opinion. People say, well, we knew these things. We didn't actually. And people feel now, I spoke to one person who said, I feel like an idiot for giving all this information to Facebook and other social media without ever thinking that they're going to pass it on to someone else, or it's going to be made public, or it will go to the intelligence services. So people are much more aware now that privacy doesn't mean private anymore.
Ewan, during the course of this story, we should say, or since you were involved in breaking it, you've relocated from the US to the UK. So you've seen two different debates at work. Do you think they're very different debates, or is it the same sort of thing?
In America from day one, and up until I left, there was never a day that the NSA story was not in the news. It was on TV, it was on radio, it was in the papers. Because the attitude in America, because of the Constitution, and they've got privacies is enshrined in the Constitution, people regard it as a fundamental right. So it's always in the top of their head. You come to Britain, and the debate was really slow to get going. Maybe it's British history, because we haven't been invaded for hundreds of years, there's a sense of complacency. Maybe it's the rest of the media don't like The Guardian because of the phone hacking thing. But now, finally, within the last few months, you're seeing signs that Britain is engaging in the debate too. Liberal Democrats have picked that up, and now Ed Miliband's promised that the Labour will have a look at it too.
But it's kind of very much still, isn't it, Luke, in the UK, that even the opposition is saying, oh, we might have a look at this. It doesn't feel to me like something where as oppositions go, they've got a bit between their teeth on this one.
Well, there's good reason for that too, because actually both of the main political parties, Labour and Conservatives, have, you might argue, been complicit in this. In other words, the fibre optic cable tapping that I was sort of mentioning earlier on, this was a Labour Foreign Secretary, David Miliband, possibly his predecessors as well, who secretly, without consulting with the National Security Council, signed off on this. And the response from David Cameron, in my view, without being overly critical, has been pretty jejun, actually, since this story broke in the summer. He said Britain's spies are very brave, The Guardian has behaved irresponsibly, and move along, nothing to talk about here. But I think inevitably, as reforms are rolled out, or semi-reforms are rolled out in the US, it's going to have a knock-on effect in the UK, because one of the things we know from these documents is that GCHQ, the NSA, are practically one entity. I mean, they're completely entwined with each other, which paradoxically, of course, is why a 29-year-old contractor sitting in a beautiful Pacific island, Hawaii, was able to scrape GCHQ's servers from thousands and thousands of miles away while Whitehall was napping.
I mean, this just seems like a trivial point. In Britain, when you think of spies, you immediately think of James Bond and the all-action hero. The Guardian's not anti-intelligence or anti-spies. We recognise why they're needed, and 95% of what they do, we're glad that they're doing it, tracking down, keeping tabs on terrorists and their involvement in the Northern Ireland peace process. Lots of it's laudable. But the main image is this sort of James Bond figure. You go to Germany, they don't think James Bond. They think of the Stasi and the people in East Germany reading everybody's files and the lack of privacy. So you can see why in Germany, from day one, it was a major story. Even before the tapping of Angela Merkel, there was this huge resentment in the general population over the revelations.
They were really cross even before that, because I thought that had been the flare-up moment. That's...
Well, I mean, No. Yeah. Almost from the start, it was running. There were stories in Der Spiegel, within a few weeks of The Guardian, and the Merkel story was just something that crystallised it. Yeah. The mood was strong.
I don't entirely agree with that. I mean, I think Ewan is absolutely right, but my sense was that by late summer, the CDU, which is a kind of right-wing conservative party, had Merkel's spokesman actually said, we're going to draw a line under this affair because transatlantic relations are too important. And they were trying to move the narrative on. But then, of course, they discover that Frau Merkel has been hacked and eavesdropped for almost a decade, possibly her predecessor, Gerhard Schröder, who, as everyone knows, opposed the war in Iraq, and the armies, as the German Germans call it, had been listening in. And just, I mean, I was in Berlin as a correspondent, so I know Berlin very well, but it's just the kind of physical geography of it, which is kind of so striking, because the US embassy is right next to the Brandenburg Gate, and literally 500 meters away is the Chancellor's office. And from the top of the embassy, you can see all these antennae poking out, you know, and it now seems terribly blatant. But of course, until Snowden came along, no one noticed.
It's the same point. I mean, there was a resentment on the part of the general population. But the politicians like Merkel and the others, no matter what they say in public, protesting and how much they say they're outraged, there's no way Germany is going to part company with America over this, or stop cooperating with the cooperation between German and US intelligence, you know, despite what they say in public.
And are there any other countries, Ewan, around the world where...
This is, again, from Glenn Greenwald lives in Brazil. So he stirred it up in Brazil, and it led to the Brazilian president cancelling a state visit. You know, it was a big deal for Brazil, a state visit to Washington. She cancelled it because of once they discovered that the Americans had been tapping into the president's office. And then it was a big story in Mexico for similar reasons. And then in Indonesia, I think it's one of the most volatile reactions has been in Indonesia. Once Guardian Australia published details about the Americans listening in on the Indonesian president's personal phone, that of his wife, the first lady, and his immediate circle, the diplomats were being called back, and they stopped cooperation, which is sad. They were cooperating on dealing with refugees, and they ceased cooperation on military projects and other things. So it's had quite serious consequences in Indonesia.
Now let's just turn to what some of this has meant for The Guardian. I mean, look, your new book, the Snowden Files, is obviously... So you weren't, let's be clear, Ewan was involved in telling the story in the first place, and you're kind of telling the story about the story in the book. What do you think, taking a step back, about the pressure that The Guardian came under? Where do you think the greatest crunch point was where it... been published.
It's a fascinating story, and really it kind of, I've written it, but it does read kind of beyond the plot of any thriller, because it's just so improbable. Ewan, of course, met Snowden in Hong Kong and really was involved in all of that from the very beginning. I was part of a very small team of sort of trusted reporters who subsequently examined Snowden's documents in a secret bunker upstairs from where we're speaking. And what happened, I think, was we began writing these stories from the US and the UK, and Downing Street just didn't know what to do. They were really slow off the mark, kind of dumbfounded. I talked to one Whitehall official who said, we just sat up and thought, oh my God. So they were kind of perplexed. But then I would say by late June and July, the Cabinet Office sort of pulled itself together, and David Cameron privately sent Jeremy Hayward, the cabinet secretary, the most powerful man powerful invisible man in Britain, I call him in the book, to basically remonstrate with Alan Rusbridge at the Guardian editor and say, if you don't give this stuff back, we will injunct you. We can do this nicely, or we can go to law, is what Hayward said. And Alan pointed out that actually this wouldn't stop the flow of stories, because this material from Snowden existed in many jurisdictions. Glenn Greenwald had it in Brazil. Barton Gellman of the Washington Post had it stateside. Laura Poitras in Berlin also had material. So, and we had also partnered with the New York Times and ProPublica. But Hayward and the government were not in listening mode, and they became more and more heavy. And this culminated with this quite extraordinary scene where we were forced to smash up our own computers in the Guardian's underground car park. I describe it in the book as half Stasi and half pantomime. Watched by two boffins from GCHQ who had come down from Cheltenham, had been lurking outside the Guardian offices for some days, we think, you know, buying presents for their families, drinking coffee, and eventually they kind of came in. They brought with them this very strange machine that looked like a microwave oven called a degausser. And so my three colleagues, David Blishen, Paul Johnson, the deputy editor, and Sheila Fitzsimons, spent 3 hours smashing and bashing and deconstructing this stuff. And then it was posted into the degausser like a little kid posting shapes into a sort of plastic bucket. And that was it. The boffins, we nicknamed them the Hobbits, they went home. And effectively, 21st century Britain a Western democracy, a newspaper, a major newspaper, had been forced to destroy its journalistic material on the secret orders of the government.
The real contrast, I was in New York when this was happening, and there's a real contrast with America. In the States, I was talking to the White House and the NSA and the Director of National Intelligence Department, and apart from a few testy exchanges with the US editor Jeanine Gibson at the start, they were unfailingly polite and cooperative. You would say, look, this is what we're planning to write. Is this going to be a problem? We don't want to do anything that's going to endanger lives or endanger operational. And there was constant dialogue. The idea of that the Americans would go and force anyone into a newspaper office and, oversee the destruction of hard drives, it's just not going to happen. The press freedoms, they're under attack in America just now. A lot of pressure from Obama administration on some journalists. But overall, there's a recognition, there's a right to a free press. And there's no way that the Americans would ever do anything like that. The White House spokesman was asked about what had happened to The Guardian in Britain, and he said at the White House briefing, absolutely no way we would ever do anything like that. We don't have the files in the Guardian office in London anymore. If we want to see them, we have to go to the New York Times office, where they're in a special room there.
We had a partnership.
We've got a partnership.
They've got the same material. So smashing up these computers was a totally empty gesture.
It was dumb. But there's no way that the FBI or CIA or NSA police or anyone else is going to invade the offices of the New York Times. It's just not going to happen. So there's a real contrast. We need something similar to the Americans. We need some sort of amendment that says there's a right to a free press, a right to free speech.
Although they do talk about there was an act, wasn't there, a sort of First World War act that some people thought could be used against journalists but never had been.
It's an espionage act. Yeah, but the chance of that ever getting a successful prosecution.
But was that a very live fear in the American office that this thing was going to be brought down on you or not?
Because of the scale of the leaks, we thought there'd be some sort of retribution. There'd be a grand jury, and some of us would be secretly hauled in front of a grand jury, or, there might be, just because of our association with Snowden. But none of that's happened.
Now, it's turning to your account of it all, though. There were some fairly bizarre things immediately after the first story. Bits of the pavement being dug up, and taxi drivers who seemed a bit odd, and...
Yeah, that's right. I did two trips to New York and talked to you and talked to Jeanine Gibson. And she told me that within hours of putting this first story about the US telecoms company Verizon and the fact that secretly it was handing over everybody's data to the NSA, that the whole lot was going to the NSA. So basically, a whole load of kind of diggers arrived. They very efficiently, this is a Wednesday evening, this isn't Monday morning, they dug up the pavement outside the office and they fiddle around with it, and then they re-tarmacked. The same thing happened outside the Guardian's bureau in DC, four blocks from the White House, outside Jeanine's home in Brooklyn. And, well, I mean, you can accuse us of paranoia, or you can say that actually, at this point, the NSA was probably scrambling to find out what the hell we had. And at the same time, Jeanine's encrypted chats with Glenn Greenwald kept on crashing as if someone else was trying to go in on the conversation. And this all sounds a bit nuts until you see the documents. They actually confirm this is precisely what the NSA can do. But I think one of the interesting corollaries of all this is how we as journalists, as investigators, have changed our methods. In other words, if I see you and we want to talk about something sensitive, we dump our mobile phones and go and find a little quiet thing in the corner. If I've got a source, I no longer communicate by email. We've gone back in time. It's like falling through a wormhole. I mean, dozens of Guardian staff flew to Rio, stayed at the Marriott on Copacabana Beach, which I have to say was not the most unpleasant experience of my life. because that was the only way to communicate with him securely. And I joke in the book, how long before the return of the carrier pigeon? I mean, we now have Indian diplomats in London who are so mistrustful that they've gone back to typewriters and walks in the garden. I mean, it was suddenly back in the world of Smiley as if the internet never existed.
There's some interesting things in the book. I mean, partly about Glenn Greenwald's sort of technophobia, meaning that this scoop almost didn't happen. Is that fair to say, when he didn't install it?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to Glenn when I was in Rio. He told me the story. Essentially, Snowden, to use an American verb, reached out to Glenn Greenwald in December of 2012. By this point, he decided he was going to leak this material and thought that Glenn was a suitable recipient. And he sent an email saying, you know, can you install encrypted software? And Glenn, at the best of times, is someone who's deeply overstretched with numerous demands. He had a book deadline. His phone was ringing. He lives with a bunch of dogs that were jumping on his head. And he didn't do it. So Snowden followed up. And Glenn still didn't do it. And then Snowden sent a kind of Khan Academy encryption guide for dummies, a sort of video, this is how you do it. And Glenn still didn't do it. And we can only speculate on what was going through Snowden's mind, but we do know that about a month later, after false starting, he then emailed Laura Poitras, the US filmmaker, who was a close friend of Glenn's, and said, I am a senior member of the intelligence community. You know, this won't be a waste of your time. And Laura is very good at encryption. And the two started kind of corresponding.
You've met Edward Snowden, you and himself. One thing that's fascinating, but I think also puzzling in Luke's book, is what was his motivation? It's obviously the case that he's got, what in British terms might be a fairly eccentric set of political views, you know, sort of libertarian, lefty, if you like, on some things, and very right-wing cutback government spending on everything on the other. But, I mean, he wasn't just taking a risk. He was taking a plunge into near-certain imprisonment at some point, sure. Wasn't he?
I mean, just to follow on from what Luke said, when I went to Hong Kong, I thought I was only going for 2 days, you know, because I thought this guy was a total fantasist. You know, the idea that there'd be a real-life spy in Hong Kong, it never really occurred to me. When I went, I thought, 2 days, establish this guy's leading us up the garden path and go back to... And he was for real. I then, myself and Glenn Greenwald and Laura Petraeus interviewed him for 6 days solid, sometimes together, sometimes on our own. The question I came back to is the question that you've just asked. To me, it seemed extremely odd that somebody was prepared to risk life imprisonment for the sake of the idea of internet freedom. Maybe I'm the wrong generation. I was 61 at the time and Snowden was 29. I couldn't grasp the concept. And I said to him over and over again, you're going to destroy your life. You're ruining your life for this sort of nebulous idea of sort of privacy and, you know, having the right to privacy on emails and internet. And for him, it was absolutely essential. He comes from a libertarian background, which in Europe 100 years ago was a left-wing thing, but in America it's now right-wing. And it believes in sort of small government. It believes, above all, in the Constitution, and that Constitution guarantees you a right to privacy. He supported Ron Paul, who's a presidential candidate, stands in a libertarian platform, to the right of whoever the established Republican candidate is. So he comes from that libertarian, right-wing spectrum in America. And for him, it was worth sacrificing his life, and that's what he's ended up doing. I mean, he's not a happy bunny being in Russia. He'd much rather be in Germany or Scandinavia, or preferably back in his own homeland. But none of that looks very likely, as Luke says in his book. To me, it was an extraordinary sacrifice, and I admire him for it.
I mean, Luke, one of the most interesting things that I learned from your book, which I hadn't picked up, I don't know if I missed it in the reams of coverage, is that as recently as, you know, 5 or 6 years before this story broke, though, he wasn't being a purist, Paul-style Republican libertarian. He was raging against the New York Times for exposing what he thought were dangerous state secrets.
That's right. He was posting on this technology forum, Ars Technica, and working in Geneva at the US mission there as basically the tech guy, the guy who sorted out the computers, the aircon, and so on. And at one point in 2009, the New York Times published a rather sensitive...
2009?
Yeah.
So rather, very recently.
Very recently, rather sensitive national security story about operations in Iran and Israel. And he... yeah, lots of expletives basically about how they shouldn't be releasing this shit. It's classified for a reason and so on and so on. But I think, I mean, he's a young man. Bear in mind that people change, and the more information he had, the more disillusioned he became. He had several run-ins with his superiors, we know about. I mean, I say in the book that this idea of being a whistleblower at that point was inchoate, which I think is true. But by the time he got to Japan, the Japan episode is somewhat murky, I have to say.
About what he was doing.
Yeah, well, we know he was working for Dell. He was working at an NSA facility. But he hasn't really spoken publicly about Japan. There's more information on Hawaii, but certainly he arrives in Hawaii in March 2012. And at this point, he's essentially decided he's going to take matters into his own hands because, as he told Ewan, that he had been waiting for the Obama administration to unravel this surveillance state as he saw it, and it didn't happen.
And do you think the example of Julian Assange had maybe changed his way of thinking?
It's quite interesting you mentioned Julian Assange in The Guardian. It's my spine starts... as you know, the Julian Assange fell out with The Guardian in 2011 and said some very nasty things about us subsequently. I think there are some parallels with Julian Assange. Both are big critics of the security state and of mass surveillance. But I think you should probably ask Ewan, because it seems to me, having met Julian, I haven't met Snowden, but I worked with Julian for a while, that they're completely different personalities and temperaments. And Julian's philosophy is absolutist. He thinks, release all information, official information, and governments will be brought to account and will be transparent and the world will be better. Whereas Snowden's methodology was very different. It was, give this material to trusted senior journalists, ask them to exercise their editorial judgment and publish some of it, which was in the public interest, which is different philosophy.
And so you think he's got a more conventional morality approach to these things, maybe, than Assange?
Me, Assange is one of the kings of, you know, self-publicity. He's fantastic. Any story he can grab a hold of and try and put himself at the centre of. Snowden's quite shy, quite self-effacing. He's one of these people that, you know, he loves being on his laptop, and the guy that we all know that sort of sits at night in his room, you know, get in touch with mates or around the world on the computer, quite nerdy, happiest when he's talking about technical issues, you know, rather than broad politics. But he's self-effacing, modest. He hasn't sought the limelight. He's given a few interviews, but they tend to be mainly on broad constitutional issues. Apart from the initial interviews in Hong Kong, he's spoken very little about his personal life. He hasn't done this for fame. So he's very, very different person from Assange.
Luke, especially as a former Moscow correspondent, you'll have seen the journalist from The Economist, Edward Lucas, at least raising the question about why the mild-mannered Mr. Snowden ended up in Russia, and kind of at least half suggesting that maybe it's all a giant Russian plot. Would you like to knock that down or grapple with it?
Well, I'm a big admirer of Ed Lucas, and he's written a couple of very good books on Russia. But I think on this particular point, I think he's wrong, because I think the evidence doesn't actually stack up. His thesis is that this was or may have been a kind of Russian intelligence operation stretching back some years. Even intelligence officials talking to the New York Times over the weekend have suggested that this is not the case, that this was a sort of self-starting leak done for patriotic reasons. They don't like it, but by one man. He didn't mean to end up in Moscow. His plan was to, top of the list was Iceland, but then his plan was to go to Latin America, but he got stuck. The US revoked his passport, and he's been there ever since. But, you know, I write in the book that this is tricky for Snowden, because his narrative is one of principled exile, but for better or worse, he's now landed in this gloomy, authoritarian state run by someone who used to be in the KGB. And, you know, when Snowden says that he hasn't shared any material with the Russians, I believe him. I think that's absolutely true. And that he's not interested in collaborating with Russian spy agencies. But I also think one has to acknowledge that they may be interested in him. And to suggest that some of his kind of most fervent supporters are, that he's a completely free entity, you know, and the Kremlin has got no interest or involvement beyond providing him asylum, I think is somewhat naive.
And he's got Kremlin-friendly lawyers working for him. And
well,
so on,
he has. He has, I mean,
they will look after him, won't they?
Just to be clear, I'm not suggesting that Snowden is cooperating or collaborating. I'm merely saying that for anyone who knows Russia, it's inconceivable. I mean, I've talked to Russian journalists and lawyers about this. It's inconceivable. The FSB would not be interested in him.
Mm.
I don't know. What does Ewan think?
And Ewan, yeah, final word to you.
No, I agree with... look, he never meant to end up in Russia. Neither the American or British intelligence agencies think he's a Russian spy. He's got temporary asylum in Russia till the end of July. If he's, if for some reasons the Russian says, look, we're not extending this, he's got another year to appeal. So he's got basically another, year and a half in Russia. The Russians have said, look, we're going to keep extending it. The danger for Snowden is that if Putin thinks, well, his propaganda value is diminishing, because he's useful to them just now. Whenever the Americans hit Russia over the head over human rights, they turn around and point to Snowden. Mm. But if a few years down the line they think, well, he's less value to us now, let's swap him for some high-profile Russian prisoner in America, then I think that's a real danger. So from Snowden's point of view, he wants to get out of Russia as fast as he can, maybe to some friendly Scandinavian country, maybe Germany, but that doesn't look like it's going to happen. So I think he's the only place is going to be for quite a long time to come is Russia.
And finally, Ewan, having spoken to him and looked him in the eye, you're convinced he's for real?
When I went to Hong Kong and the initial interviews to try and establish his credibility, I went through his social security number, CIA ID he had, and various things all right through his life. When he was telling me his life story, worked for CIA, worked for NSA, trained with the special forces, I thought, this is ludicrous. This guy cannot have done all these things. But he finally convinced me. And then before I left New York, Janine Gibson said, look, if this guy is for real, here's the code. Just send me a text message saying the Guinness is good. And if he's not real, say the Guinness is bad. So I sent that text message, the Guinness is good. When that message arrived in New York, Janine Gibson and her deputy Stuart Miller went, fantastic, we've got a story.
Job done. Right, well, thanks very much indeed, Ewan, and also to Luke Harding, whose book The Snowden Files is out now with Guardian Faber. And available on the Guardian Bookshop. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.